I'd like to start, as Sokozan often does, by thanking you for being here. This community is so enriched by your presence and your participation and your dedication towards practicing in the way that works or supports you. And we'd like to ask you that if you're in a position to help support us, continue to make these teachings available. Your donations are so greatly appreciated for those of you that donate and those that you are able to. But beyond that, again, it's your presence and your commitment to practice that makes this community so powerful. This evening, our Dharma talk is titled Addicted to Thoughts. Addicted to Thoughts. And this is a difficult area to look at. It's a difficult area to look at because it is and has been, for most of us, the singular tool by which we navigate our world. But it's such a conditioned and habituated response. And so I thought maybe it would be helpful to start with an example. So we just spent the last 15, 16, 17 minutes meditating. And over the course of those 15 minutes, probably more thoughts than you could count come up. And we're really inspired to practice meditation and try to understand what that is. And we're looking for any reference point by which to gauge our meditation practice. And so we take these thoughts, which arise very simply initially. The image Sokozan sometimes uses is clouds. Very simply, they arise, they're just functioning. And in order to reify or reaffirm our positionality and our value and our validity, we take those thoughts and we feel that we have to derive meaning from them. We're really unwilling to let something arise as it arises and just present itself. And so while we're sitting, we evaluate our meditation practice by what kind of thoughts arise. So sometimes we have times where we sit down to meditate and the thoughts are very soft, perhaps a bit spacious, not too intrusive. And so we look at that and we jump to the conclusion, well, that was a good meditation. It's a good meditation, not much showed up. And then tomorrow we sit down and we're bombarded by impulses. We're bombarded by negativity, by anger, by aggression, by depression, by fear, by just twisting, ruminating, chaotic thoughts. And we think to ourselves, that was terrible. I wish I meditated like I did yesterday. And so there's this addiction that we have to do something with our thoughts. And so in meditation, the way we work with this addiction, this impulse, this conditioning, this reactivity, is that while we don't accomplish anything, we're not encouraged to act aggressively towards our thoughts, we're reminded of the intention to receive the thoughts. And that's a reminder that many of us need to hear over and over again. I know in the 14 years I've been studying with Sokozan, it's a reminder that I still need today. Because sometimes the thoughts are so convincing, they're so seductive, they have to be acted upon. And then we're reminded, just observe. And observing thoughts is not an accomplishment. Observing thoughts, when you sit down to meditate, you can't accomplish meditation. It's not a static situation where now I'm meditating, I've accomplished it, I can check all the boxes. But the intention is what allows us to have an inkling of softness. It's not a demand. It's when I sit down, regardless of what happens, I'm intending to observe. And in that sense, no matter how frightening and demonic the thought is or angelic the thought is, when we return to that intention, we see that we can't fail at meditation. You can't accomplish it because it's not activities. It's not a state of mind. It's not a feeling. It's not a particular thought. But if the intention is to observe, you can't fail at meditation because what is arising is not indicating how your meditation is going. And so this small container, this relatively limited container of meditation, which we practice for many of us every day, it's like a small, safe example of the entirety of our world. Because when we get up off the cushion, the thoughts are so much more seductive. They're almost amplified. Or perhaps our awareness is softened in such a way that we're more prone to just reacting out of impulse. Those thoughts are so conditioned to come with an impulse, to come with a reaction. And so if we were to take an example outside of meditation, the one I often go to is anger. That when we're moving about and something makes us angry, we don't really have the safety of the container of the body holding very still to begin to watch that fire crackle. And so when anger arises, we do many things with it, but traditionally one of three things with it. We act out of it. We validate it in such a way where we fight with somebody, we blame somebody, we blame ourselves. We create a story to justify why it's okay to act aggressively. We go into some sort of trying to pacify it, we might call passion. We take the anger and we try to talk ourselves out of it because it's so frightening to have that kind of rage, that kind of impulse to act in such a way that, you know, even in a small way causes harm to ourselves or others. And the last way would be ignorance. We try to find a way to ignore it, to shut down on the anger. Sometimes in pretty benign ways. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to watch a movie. Sometimes not so benign. Anything we can do to just stop the mind from doing what the mind does. And so the addiction is that even when we have these ideas that our thoughts don't demand us act out of them, that the concept doesn't go far enough. Just knowing that it's a thought that's arising in consciousness is not enough because we're so seduced. It's like, if I can't feel bad, I'd rather feel shitty. At least I get to be something. At least I get to be somebody. And so we utilize this container of meditation to not accomplish accepting our thoughts, to not accomplish not having negative thoughts, but to begin to train the mind to see the way the impulse arises. Sokazan gave a talk a number of years ago. I think we studied that talk a few times. It's called See the Impulse. So we can't see the impulse, which is what we're endeavoring to look at to some extent in meditation. If we can't see the impulse, we're already acting. And no matter how complicated and elaborate our philosophies and ideologies and our intentions are, if we've not seen the impulse, it's already action before we recognize it. And so it somewhat brings up the question, what is that? What is it that's so convincing? Why is it that we feel like we have to make meaning out of everything that arises? Why is it that we have to constantly draw conclusions? And I know I just did two why questions. And I think for a lot of us, it is just this tremendous amount of fear we feel when we don't know what to do. And it is frightening. I feel it's quite frightening to step into any situation without an agenda. For any of you that experience like a social anxiety, you've always got a plan. You've got a plan of when to get there, how you're going to sustain, okay, and an escape plan. Maybe some of you have that. I always have an escape plan. Because it's not comfortable to have to be with the raw.
How's that escape plan working?
I'm trapped. The way it used to work, this is to devolve a little bit. Before I moved to the monastery, before I started studying with Sokazan, I was a musician. And I played a lot of gigs, I played a lot of festivals, and so you can't play a music festival without, you know, 1,000 people showing up. And no matter how crappy you are, we weren't very good. People are still like, oh, that's the musician. I want to talk to them. And so if I was playing, I learned the way out without going through the crowd. And if I went to see a show, I always left like right before the last song ended. And so I'd go see my friends And at first they'd be like, where were you? And I was like, I was there. I just left. And then after a while they stopped asking because they knew at that time, Kyle had already slipped out the door. They'd see him tomorrow. there's no escape here at the monastery. And what's interesting is, to come back to the talk, there's really no escape from your mind. That's something Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said, is when somebody's looking for you, you can hide from them. So when somebody's looking for you, when someone wants to talk to you about your music, or a friend wants to talk to you, you can hide from them. But when nobody's looking for you, you can't hide from yourself. And that's where the addiction to thoughts comes up. Is it is in that addiction that we can hide out. It is in that fixation to our beliefs and the fixation to our emotions and the strategy, the agendas, that we can hide out from the first noble truth that the Buddha taught, really the foundational truth. And that is, life is suffering. And that if you're joining us for the first time, it's kind of like, what? Life is suffering. I thought Buddhists were happy. But the Buddha said life is suffering because we want that which is impermanent to be permanent. We want that which is good to last and it can't last. We want that which is bad to go away and it keeps returning. And it's when we are not constantly fueling the thoughts that we're kind of stuck having to look at this ease of not being sure of what we're doing or what's happening or who we are. And my older brother once said to me, my greatest fear is to be alone with my thoughts. And he doesn't realize it, but there's some insight in that if he had a willingness to be with those thoughts. Because anyone who's maybe a bit direct with themselves recognizes why it would be so frightening to be with our own thoughts. Because we can't escape. So Buddhism encourages us to be genuine, to be sincere. And so your ideations of who you want to be, an addiction to thought, a constant addiction to the future, a constant belief in what's to come, saves us from having to be with the sincerity of somebody who has an inclination towards anger or fear or jealousy or any other negative aspect. And it is because of this that I feel that meditation has to have such a wide open approach, that when you sit down to meditate, the attitude, not the fruition, the attitude, not the accomplishment, is that every single thing that arises has a right to be there just in its showing up. That does not translate to meaning. Everything has a right to be there just in that it shows up. Does not mean that has the value or lack of value that you impute. And I think the clouds are a wonderful example. It's kind of nice. It's a nice sunny day. And Sokazan has given that instruction many times, that meditation is like watching clouds in the sky. And it's really quite comical if you think about it, because if you think of the clouds as your thoughts, nobody would go outside. Well, some of you might. But most of us wouldn't go outside and think that by looking up at the cloud and screaming at it, that it would change. Or that by throwing stones at it, it would make a difference. And yet we take that attitude towards our thought that if we can just exert enough pressure, enough force, enough logic, that we can derail this train of causes and conditions, this train of karma. And Buddhism instead says we need to work with the raw material of our life. So if your clouds are thunder clouds, if your clouds are snow clouds, if your clouds are cirrus or cumulonimbus clouds or anything else, it's like that's the raw material of the mind. If it's anger, if it's jealousy, if it's fear, that we don't need to indulge it. We don't need to get rid of it. And we don't need to look for something else. And it's in this sense that we begin to shift our allegiance to the space itself. We begin to shift our allegiance to the blue sky. we begin to shift our allegiance to the space, which doesn't reject, it doesn't oppose the thoughts, but it's not so tied into the addictive quality that we have to do something with the thoughts. And I say this as somebody who still finds myself being seduced into those stories. And that's not incorrect either. At least I've been told. But through sitting down, simplifying, holding the body still, and just allowing ourselves that brief moment of an attitude of reception, of observing, we might begin to recognize that our ability to live a sane and helpful and kind life does not, it doesn't need to wait until all of our negativity is dissipated. That if we can see the negativity and see the way in which it wants us to act out of it, we have a better chance of not functioning out of the negativity, but actually being able to be with the negativity and also be able to look at what is showing up in front of us. And the other image that shows up that Sokazan used to use was of a bonfire. It's like if you actually see very crisply, very cleanly that it's a bonfire, you don't need any philosophy not to stick your hand in it. You don't have to, I wouldn't, if we had a bonfire, I wouldn't have to say, Evan, please don't stick your hand in the bonfire. I hope not. But the mind goes to any lengths to make it seem seductive. So we take the anger and we think that the bonfire is actually like Mardi Gras beads. Like, oh, that looks good. So we have to see it very clearly. That's the addiction. The addiction is taking what is very clearly a bonfire and telling a story to make it seem, oh, I want that bonfire. I want to put my hand in. And so the path, fortunately and unfortunately, comes with a lot of disappointment. The disappointment being that our negativity is not just going to disappear, that we are still going to be embodied in such a way where we experience suffering, pain, disappointment. But the fortunate part is that we recognize that just because that continues to arise does not keep us from living a sane life. But it is based on that foundation of awareness, of beginning to see clearly how those prejudice, that's a tricky word, prejudices, become more and more subtle. And because there's a consensus around us in society that justifies it, we don't even look at it. And so mind training. And before I take questions, there was one thing I wanted to share this evening. I have been reading this book called Vivid Awareness, and it's a commentary on a very, very short text, like 10 pages, by one of Trungpa Rinpoche's teachers. Trungpa Rinpoche being Sokazan's root guru, who came to the States from Tibet after the Chinese occupation, Kempo Gangshar. And in the commentary, there's a verse from Shantideva, who was an early Indian Buddhist master who is known for teaching about the bodhisattva path, or the path of putting others' well-being before our own, or a path of service, or cultivating awakening to benefit others. And the verse reads, "To cover all the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? But with the leather soles of just my shoes, it is as though I cover all the earth." And I really liked that until I shared it with Biyun, and she said, well, that's kind of morbid. And I hadn't thought about like the skin. But what to me is being said is that as meditators, as practitioners, you know, before we start practicing, we just see the faults of the world and we're constantly trying to cover them up. So that's what the leather is. Like leather, like if there's a field of glass, and you put leather over it, you're not going to get glass in your feet. And so we're constantly trying to soften the edges of the world. And so there's a never-ending job we have, you know, 8.5 billion people on Earth. And who knows how many hectares or acres to cover. But by training our own mind, by training just this very moment, it's like we just put a piece of leather over our feet so that wherever we go, we can be there. We can be there. We don't have to modify the world. So just the world, we actually work on the awareness for ourselves. So with that, I'd see if there are any questions that I could respond to. Jinshu.
Jinshu Valley, why is the knowledge that life is suffering not enough to cut through it when the suffering actually happens to us?
I talked about this a little bit in book study, and it seems to me it's like that enormous gap between the concepts and the actuality. So the thing about concepts like that, they're inspiring, or maybe they resonate and they magnetize us on an intellectual level, like be kind. No one's going to particularly argue with that. Yes, that sounds great. Your religion's about kindness. I'm all in. Let's do it. But it is when we're confronted with the actuality of a situation, that habituation, the conditioning to react and respond, is not conceptual. So we can't just uproot what has been conditioned over decades or for some lifetimes by just having a nice thought about it. But what those concepts can do for some of us is inspire us to get our hands dirty by going into the actual experience. And so the way I talked about that today was, it's like with this idea of questions. Sometimes we are working with our world and we see something very petty arise in our mind. And what we do is we cover it up by saying, well, it's just a projection of my mind. Or I need to take responsibility for that. Any other slogan that kind of invalidates it. But we've not actually investigated that impulse to act out of it. So by asking about it, by asking a question about that negativity, we open ourselves up to a more intimate pointing at, a more intimate experience and a more intimate teaching. And so to me, that's why that there's that disconnect, that the concepts don't go far enough. The ideas are not awakening, but the ideas can give us the support to go into the dark areas of our mind, which without those concepts, we probably would just impulsively pull ourselves away from. And I think that's why we need to keep the idea of returning, because it's not going to just happen the first time. It's not like you hear these teachings, you practice, and then the next time an impulse to cause harm shows up, you go, oh, don't cause harm. But you notice how you still get pulled in, and so you return to the intention to observe, and then you get pulled in, you see the return to the intention to observe. So the concepts can provide us with a touchstone to just encourage us to keep going as the teacher does. It's a touchstone to encourage us. Yes, keep going. I know it doesn't feel good. I know it's continuing to get its claws into you, but keep looking at that. After 100 times, it's hard to get yourself to do it. So sometimes you need the extra push.
Jim Chivalry. If something feels difficult and we impulsively go to thoughts like, why is this happening to me, or something like that, how can we, I think you used the term or the phrase, get our hands dirty. How can we go into that if we've already impulsively tried to get rid of it intellectually?
At no point, to me, is it not possible. So sometimes the instruction is to stay with the first thought, but that's just an instruction. It's not a demand. And so say you have this impulse and then you yell at somebody. So you've got impulse, then you yell at somebody, then the next step is you feel remorse and you want to come back to step one. But you've already gone impulse, gotten mad, feel shameful. And it's in that shame that you need to look at it, because going backwards, it's not going backwards. It's just adding a fourth layer of confusion onto it. So it's actually in the midst of the very thought that is arising as soon as you notice it. And it's not necessarily trying to backtrack into some more pure aspect. It's actually probably feels shittier to have to look at it at the third elaboration, because you feel accomplished if you see it at the impulse level. You're like, oh, I didn't act on that, which is great. But you actually get to see the whole train of elaborations. And so that is getting your hands dirty. That is just the absolute devastation of being a failure at what you were intending to do. And it brings us back to that idea that we've left the intention for accomplishment. The idea of having failed the path by having elaborated shows us that we're still tied in, that it's not just an intention, it's like a demand on ourselves to be different. And so I just come back to, in as far as we can, in whatever form of elaboration the mind or experience is at, that's the area to look at. And I think that's what we were talking about this afternoon with Dogen, is talking about the essence. It's like at no point is the essence blocked off. It's there when it's at the impulse level. It's there when it's at the outburst level. It's there at the shame level. It's there at the level when we go back into ignorance. And so I find there's some relief in that the way in which it shows up, that's the way that I'm being encouraged to look at. Thank you. Further questions? Chanjian.
Are there certain aspects of impulse generally to look at, to investigate?
I would say whatever aspects you're able to recognize and to come to like kind of a path quality, the ways that I've been instructed that have been helpful are things like that teaching, don't do anything unless you have to, has been really helpful to me, because I'm always feeling like I need to do something. Like if I don't do something, it'll fall apart. If I don't do something, then it won't go my way. And so there's an impulse that when you don't hook that up, it's like a burning impulse, because it's like, for me, there's an anxiety of like, how long can I not do anything? How long can I go before I ask Senshu to please take the garbage off of the handle and put it in the trash? And it's hard. The other ones are in that simple way. You know, we haven't heard this one in a little while, but the 90-10 that Sokudan talked about, listening 90% of the time, talk 10%, that shows us impulse, because we're so interested in sharing. We're so interested in telling people about our experiences. And so when we put ourselves in a situation and just listen, especially if it's something we're passionate about or interested in, like I was watching baseball with you and I couldn't help but like just tell you about stuff that you probably didn't care about at all. It's really hard for me to watch baseball and not tell somebody the cool things I'm seeing. But you take that attitude of listening, you see the impulse. So I would say that that's very personal, but in those teachings help us create enough of a pause to see how strong the impulse to express ourselves is. And it's not that we shouldn't express ourselves and that we shouldn't engage or we shouldn't share what we're passionate about, but putting a little bit of attention on it helps us see what our intention around that is, I think. Is there more or more specific around that?
No, I think that's helpful. I guess I was wondering if there's some sort of kind of catch-all textures or little box. I guess I'm trying to put it in a box, like areas in which to see the impulse or to kind of capture it, but.
I think the box is like the Zabuton. The Zabotons are these black mats we're sitting on. It's like there's a box that catches it all. It would be that. Because one you could look at too is the impulse to get up for meditation, the impulse to move during meditation. And we are encouraged to move as we need to move and get up as we need to get up. But we're not told what that means. Like, there's not a list of like, here's the 20 reasons that it's okay to move, or the 20 reasons it's okay to get up. We're just said, you know, you're respected. If you need to get up and use the restroom, use the restroom. If you need to get up, if you need to stretch, if you need to move. But as we're sitting there, notice, or you could try to notice, if you move before you know you're going to move. If you move before you know you are going to move. If you get up before you know you're going to get up. It's like, almost, can you be very intentional with it? You look at the body, you feel the sensation in the knee. I'm going to adjust my knee. I think for me, there's a lot of impulse to be seen in those areas.
What about, how is intention so, why, yeah, how is intention so important? I mean, how can it help us see the moment of our reaction, our impulse, our...
So what's interesting about what you just said is that you went from intention to accomplishment. How does our intention lead to this? Which isn't a problem. I mean, that's very much how we're used to talking about intention. But that's the power of the intention, is that it doesn't have to lead to anything. And to me, intention is so closely related to spaciousness, and that the spaciousness can accommodate. So if our intention is fixated upon a result, we're going to have to reject a lot of things in order to get to that result. So like, it's a very narrow view. Whereas the intention, which it may be an intention to be kinder, that's a result, or it's an intention to train the mind. But if it is just the intention, it's never at the expense of anything. It's the bodhisattva path. It's the space which accommodates, which acknowledges or welcomes what arises. And so it's interesting, because in that way, we might actually be able to see the impulse, but the way in which we see it may be far broader and far more expansive than if we were to look at it as an accomplishment. So it's just that incredible amount of space that is there to not need to know what's going to happen. And therefore, you're able to watch very closely what does happen. So that's the area, at least for me, I'm also looking at, is how there are more and more subtle layers of me wanting to take the intention and turn it into a result. And so that's why that word return is always used there. Maybe not always, but often used. Return to the intention is what we hear from Sokazan. Return to the intention, return to the intention. And that's it. And I think it shows a lot of respect. And it also allows us to go into the unknown, because we don't know how to go into it if we don't know what it is. But if we have just the intention, when it arises, we don't reject it because it's not in line with what we think it should be. So I think there's a lot of power to that kind of intelligence we invite in, that kind of spaciousness. And I think it takes a lot of curiosity. I think it takes a little bit of maturity, a little bit of curiosity and courage, you could say, because it is inviting in things that traditionally you would be told to reject or to get rid of or to not be distracted by.
Divine, is it helpful to have the intention to see impulsiveness versus our greater vow? To be with all things, you know, to have smaller intentions, I guess, bowing?
I think that's a good question. I don't know that it would be a versus, though. I think that our intention to be with all things, and the intention to see impulses, that's a very, very much a part of that path. That's very much a part of being with all things, being with the impulse. So to me, that's been a helpful teaching, that talk, see the impulse. That distinction, we've talked about this before. This is where Sokazan tells us to look. There's impulse and grasping. And it's somewhere in that area of impulse before it turns to grasping that we're not quite enslaved to the thought. And so I would say intending to see the impulse is important. And if it's already shifted into grasping, if it's already become grasping, you don't need to abandon that for the going back to the impulse, but you could just look at how you're fixated. So just to simplify, I think that the intention to see the impulse is a completely valid and supportive part of our practice. And I say that knowing that that may not be the case for everybody, but that for some of us, that's an important area for us to look. And that may not be the case in a week, or it may be the case the rest of our lives. And you can't really lay it down like that. Thank you. Any questions from those joining on Zoom this evening? Just a few more minutes. Any other questions here in Zendo? Go ahead, Ondo.
Ondo Bain, what is the difference between addiction and habit? I mean, we're talking about impulse, conditioning, habit, and addiction.
So the delineation is, as you know, is completely fabricated. I mean, it's like, what is the difference between these two things? The difference is, how do you define them? But that being said, I think there's ways to go into that. So the addiction to me has a lot to do with the grasping. And then you've got the impulse. The impulse is, you could say it's like tendency. It's just, you just have a tendency of a conditioned response to stimuli. But it is at the level of how we elaborate around it, and then the demand we place on it, where it becomes a type of fixation. And I don't want to get too complicated, but the form we talk about, one of the forms we talk about in Buddhism would be the five skandhas, and I think it speaks to that. So you have this five skandhas, and these are five things that conceptually we talk about come together to form the illusion of a self or an identity. So before these five skandhas, you have this term vidya. Vidya is a Sanskrit word that could mean intelligence, or it's spaciousness. And it's at this first skandha where we have avidya, we have ignorance form. So discrimination begins by differentiating and creating boundaries. You have form. So first skandha is just the most primal differentiation. And then you have feeling. You begin to have sensation. So these forms begin to come into contact. So it creates the further belief and distinction. It's not only can you recognize the boundary, but they can interact, so therefore they have to be different. Now the third one is perception, impulse. So not only have they come into contact, but you begin to recognize them and you have a reaction, which is, it's good, bad, or neutral. Not passion, aggression, and ignorance quite. It's like the fire is hot, you move away from it. The feather is soft, you lean into it. You don't particularly feel the hair. So form, delineation, feeling, contact, perception, recognition. And then you have concept, the elaborations that begin. We begin to strategize. We begin to create systems and logic and reason. We begin to compartmentalize. We begin to discriminate apples and oranges. And this is where we start to get into that impulse area, because we've conditioned, we've labeled things, conditioned responses to it. And then at the level of the fifth skandha, you have consciousness. And so we take all of that, which is somewhat mechanical, and we infuse emotions. We infuse mind. We infuse like very erratic thoughts around it. And so then it becomes like an addiction. We think it's mine. I should get it. I deserve it. I, you know, it's very neurotic. It's very aggressive. And so it's kind of that distinction. We go from just that simple conditioning that we're human beings. We turn our faces towards the sun. We hear a loud noise. We go towards it. We see a fire. We move away from it. And then at the level of grasping or addiction, you start to make demands and you strategize your whole life to maintain one thing. You create these elaborate ways of approaching life so that you never have to be without. Like every thought you have is about maintaining something you can't maintain. And so it seems that the addiction and grasping state are very complex. They're very elaborate. There's a lot of stories and a great deal of energy is extended to maintain it. Whereas at the level of impulse, it seems more primal. It seems more raw. And again, I know I fabricated all of that.
It was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there... go ahead, Sokaran.
Sokaran bowing. Buddhists like to pray or say, may all beings be happy. Is what causes happiness? Bowing.
Well, there will be two types of that. There's relative happiness, which is the happiness of, you know, someone buying you flowers. Causes, like, I like flowers and someone buys you flowers, or you get to go swim in a mountain stream. Cause of happiness. It's beautiful. It's refreshing. So those are the causes of relative happiness when our surroundings match up with our desires and expectations. Those can't be maintained, as we know. You can't stay in the mountain stream forever. And if you did, it would stop being pleasurable. The intention to have fundamental happiness is that intention that we can be free from the delusions of self and other, and that we can be free from the demands of our grasping and our impulses, and that we have a willingness to live in the midst of our world as it is. And I think as Buddhists, we intend to do both. We wish, pray for the happiness of others to just be free from basic suffering, that they have enough to eat and they have a safe place to stay and they feel supported and loved. And if they can, that we also, you know, pray that they may know a type of peace that cannot be modified, and it would not be a state of mind. That's how Sokuzan talks about it. It's how it's talked throughout time, is that it's not something that you can grasp. So I think that as Buddhists, we intend for both of those. And to say one more thing about that, it's like you intend for both of those to the capacity or the willingness of those on the receiving end. So you don't force anything. You don't try to force someone to receive your kindness or force them to have a type of happiness you think they should have. It's very, very respectful and very situational. You relate to everybody in the capacity that they have to receive, or your capacity or limited capacity to see clearly. Jishin, did you have a question?
Jishin bowing. Yes, I'm trying to be precise in my question, with however I can see already a lot of complications there. Anyway, after your response to my question this afternoon, when we were talking about expressing our spiritual intention and expressing Buddha nature, and I remember asking you, can I express spiritual intention? Can I only express spiritual intention if I am a Buddha nature? I think you said something that everything is an expression of the Buddha nature. If I'm not wrong. So I'm just thinking, aren't we complicated everything? If this is the truth, aren't we complicating everything by all of those thoughts, which are addiction. If everything is an expression of the Buddha nature, can we observe our expressions as an expression of the Buddha nature? I expected this reaction.
I'd be happy to answer.
Please.
I changed my mind.
Okay. I'll respond to it. Jixin, you are doing a wonderful job. You are completely sincere and curious and thorough, and I hope you continue to ask questions and that you receive whatever response or lack of response shows up. I don't know that there will ever be a type of resolution to the question that you just asked that is going to satisfy you for long. You should keep asking about it. But to just continue to do what you're doing, that question may never resolve. You don't need to see everything as Buddha nature, but you could consider what that means. You don't need to force that type of insight onto the world and say, well, oh, this carpet is Buddha nature, and that scroll is Buddha nature, and the light is Buddha nature. It seems like we can be much more childish about it. It's like there's almost a lack of concepts. There's almost just like an awe at what is showing up. Did I thoroughly evade your question?
No, all of your examples are very, very pleasant, like butterflies. It's easy to accept it as a Buddha nature. If there's an addiction to thoughts, it's more difficult. So I'm just looking more for help how to, I guess, perhaps not to have that attitude of rejecting certain things. If I know that everything is the expression of the Buddha nature.
Don't interfere with the projections. If you're saying everything is an expression of Buddha nature, and what do I need to get rid of in order to see that, then you're saying not everything is an expression of Buddha nature. And so that's the radical inclusion, that radical willingness to, you know, you can't have any idea what you're doing because you're just in the midst of all of this movement. And so to just have a willingness to try to be with that movement. And being with movement includes being with the movement of I'm not being with this movement. And that's the addiction to thoughts, is thinking that it's the stories that's going to indicate how we're doing on the path. Come back to that example of the clouds. It's just the absurdity of thinking that there's something we're going to do that it's going to reroute the clouds. They're going to, you know, these days, maybe there are things that people can do, but we don't have the money to do them. So we're not talking about them. But I just think that I come back to when Sokazan said to me that sitting meditation is the most luxurious thing that you could ever do. And I thought, what a load of shit when he said that. And that was because I thought there was so much work to do because the thoughts were so chaotic. And my idea was that somehow I had to create order out of those thoughts. And the luxury of meditation is that it may be the only time during your day where you have no demand to accomplish anything. But as long as we think there's something to accomplish in meditation, it's going to be very tiring. It's going to be very painful. It's going to be very difficult. So what do? We just return to the intention. We have a willingness to see how much struggle we have, how we can't make sense of it, how Buddha's nature, Buddha essence, expression just doesn't make any sense. And that also is Buddha nature. That also is an invitation to just rest.
Thank you.
I think we will stand and dedicate the merit.
Hi, this is Chiezan, the prior at Sokokoji Buddhist Monastery. Sokazan offers these talks without expecting anything in return. If you value these talks and would like them to continue, please visit our donate page at www.sokukoji.org. Thank you.